Good morning, it's 9:30 on the 6th day of October of 2025. Happy Monday to you. This is a reading of the Green Valley News. Mark DeGroft with you here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. A 77-year-old elephant head man died on Saturday after his vehicle crossed the center line on Aravaca Road, according to the Pima County Sheriff's Department. Kenneth Engel was eastbound near milepost 3 at about 3:30 in the afternoon when he crossed the center line while negotiating a turn, sideswiping a second vehicle, according to PCSD. Engel was taken to a hospital where he died of his injuries, according to the Sheriff's Department. Investigators said that speed and impairment were not factors in the crash. Engel was the husband of longtime Green Valley News managing editor Kathy Engel, who died in 2016. The couple married in 1970 and had no children. Engel was an emergency dispatcher for over 20 years and in 2000 received the Tucson Fire Department Service Award for distinguished service to the department and to the community. He also was a longtime member of the ANZA Trail Riders and had volunteered driving a wheelchair-accessible vans transporting adult day care health care clients for CASA Community Services. Big Five Sporting Goods in Suarita is closing as the national retailer attempts to right the ship after a merger announced earlier this year. Signs in the windows reading "Entire store on sale and everything must go" appeared the day after Big Five completed its merger with partnership of Worldwide Golf and the Capitol Hill Group. The deal to take the company private was announced in June and finalized on Friday. The signs didn't indicate when the store would close. The Suarita store opened in 2013. Big Five closed 8 stores in early 2025 and said it planned to close 7 more by the year's end, leaving it with just over 400 locations. There are five Big Five stores in the Tucson area, one in Nogales. The retailer has faced struggling sales, reporting $20.9 million loss for the fourth quarter of 2024. The deal takes Big Five off the NASDAQ and keeps it as a subsidiary of the new partnership. Worldwide Golf is a national retailer of golf equipment and apparel, shoes, and accessories. Capital Group is in Bethesda, Maryland, and it's a private-based investment firm. A Suarita man swung into action with a fire extinguisher on Thursday night after a battery-powered desk lamp erupted into flames, catching items on his desk on fire. According to the Santa Rita Fire District, the homeowner had the fire out before the firefighters arrived. 4 people and 2 pets were inside the home at the time on West Calle Nicoya. Deputy Chief Greg Van Alstein said they won't have an estimate on the dollar loss until the homeowner meets with his insurance agent. Much of what was damaged or lost was recording equipment, he said. Van Alstein praised the homeowner for having a fire extinguisher on hand and putting it to good use. Fire extinguishers can keep small fires from beginning major ones, he said. Well, the federal government shutdown was expected to reach into this week after competing Republican and Democratic funding measures failed on Friday in the Senate. The shutdown began on Wednesday after senators couldn't reach a spending deal on Wednesday. And here's how local entities are going to be affected. The U.S. Forest Service website reported national forest recreational sites remain open during the shutdown, but that some services may be limited or unavailable. No Forest Service personnel were available to respond to questions about how services are being affected at Madera Canyon. Rusty Lombardo, friends of Madera Canyon President Emeritus, told the Green Valley News that the Forest Service told the group recreation would continue as normal, with the exception of meeting with anybody outside of the agency. Lombardo couldn't provide details as what is limited, unavailable, or otherwise affected. FOMC President Dan White said his advice is for people to be extra special stewards of Madera Canyon, not to be surprised if they don't see Forest Service personnel until the shutdown ends. He said the community should be sympathetic with the Forest Service workers who are doing their best in a very tough situation. The National Parks Service webpage for the Saguaro National Park in Tucson reported the visitor centers and East Entrance Road were closed. On Tuesday, the day before the shutdown, park staff said they didn't know what would happen if the shutdown occurred, but said that no one would be available to answer the telephones. Saguaro's webpage said that all other areas of the park are open. NPS's webpage for Tumacacuri National Historical Park, which is south of Green Valley, reported its visitor center and mission grounds are closed due to the lapse in federal appropriations. It said the Anza Trail segment through the park remains open. The Grand Canyon is open with limited services. NPS's website provides a link to the U.S. Department of Interior for more information, but the website reports that it will not update or respond to inquiries until appropriations are enacted. The Interior's group page provides the contingency plans for several agencies, including NPS, in the event of a shutdown. The Smithsonian Institute said Friday that its museums, research centers, and the National Zoo would remain open through October 11th during the federal shutdown, including the Fred Lawrence Whipple Observatory in Amato. The Whipple Science Center plans to open on October 10th for a new season. That date marks the second year it would be open since the Smithsonian completed a large-scale renovation. The center closed in 2020. Due to coronavirus pandemic restrictions and remain closed for renovations. The city will feature walking tours of the Very Energetic Radiation Imaging Telescope Array System, also known as VERITAS, and have free access to hands-on exhibits and science demonstrations. The center will also have special events on October 31st and the Friday after Thanksgiving to celebrate the observatory's 57th anniversary. Whipple's official opening date was October 23rd of 1968. It also expects to resume tours up the mountain to the MMT and Ridge telescopes in 2026, which also ended during the COVID lockdowns. U.S. Representative Juan Ciscomani said his two offices in Congressional District 6, Tucson and Sierra Vista, will remain open despite the shutdown. Ciscomani blamed Democrats for the closure, claiming they were pushing an agenda not related to the budget bill. His comments came after a virtual press conference hours before the shutdown that included social media that didn't include the Green Valley News. Green Valley is entirely in CD6. Neither Ciscomani nor his communications director responded to an inquiry about why some media were not invited. Online messaging from the federal government has cast blame on the Democrat. The Forest Service and the U.S. Department of Agriculture websites have a message stating the radical left Democrats caused the shutdown and that the sites would be updated periodically for mission-critical functions. The National Weather Service also has an alert on its website reporting that they will remain as accessible as possible during the shutdown, adding that some services would be limited or unavailable. 1 week after a Suarita resident lost $450,000 in a cryptocurrency scam, two Green Valley residents also fell victim to crypto scams. Pima County Sheriff's Department Lieutenant Brett Bernstein said that on Wednesday, a woman reported she'd received a text from her bank saying that there were issues with her account and she needed to transfer funds via Bitcoin to fix them. The 77-year-old woman lost $26,000. On the same day, another Green Valley woman, 75 years old, reported she had transferred $10,000 in Bitcoin to a man claiming to be an American soldier who needed the money to get back to the United States. She also sent him $2,000 in Apple gift cards, Bernstein said. Brian Watson, a community outreach specialist with ROSC Resources Outreach to Safeguard the Elderly, said there's a reason behind the uptick in cryptocurrency scams. The cryptocurrency ATMs are definitely the way that scammers are getting money now because the gift cards, you just can't get enough money from the gift cards, he said. The gift cards were extremely popular with con artists for a long time, but companies like Target, Walmart, and Home Depot started putting up signs to raise awareness of scams, Watson said. Watson, who writes a monthly column for the Green Valley News, also said the criminals are turning to crypto because few people understand what it is and how it really works. Criminals like to send people to methods of payment that they're not familiar with. People know cash, and they know checks, and they know debit cards and credit cards, he said. So criminals like to use wire transfers, gift cards, and crypto, and now that the gift cards are on the wane, it's definitely cryptocurrency ATMs. Plus, you don't have to deal with anybody. Watson said he has spoken with many victims of such scams, and he's come to realize that anybody is susceptible. The thing that has jumped out at me most was that these are incredibly intelligent people who handled their own finances and lived on their own. These people weren't that dependent on others or living in an assisted living home. They all had their faculties. They just got fooled, and it could happen to any of us, Watson said. Cryptocurrency is digital money that is completely unregulated. It allows people to make payments directly to each other through an online system, but it doesn't require a bank or financial institution to verify those transactions. Among the best known cryptocurrencies are Bitcoin, Dogecoin, Solana, Ethereum, and Binance Coin. However, it's not government regulated, and so authorities say it's highly attractive to con artists, drug cartels, illegal arms dealers, child pornographers, and others. And once the money is lost, there's no way of tracking it or getting it back. Watson, who teaches at the U of A, said he had Homeland Security agents speak to his class. He said that if a police officer was looking for a case, they could just park in front of a crypto ATM at a liquor store and just pull license plates, because the vast majority of the people that use that crypto ATM are either going to be people depositing drug money, illegal money, or victims depositing their hard-earned savings, Watson said. Bernstein from the Sheriff's Department said he knows of another recent case where a woman lost $65,000 in a Bitcoin scam. She transferred all of her money, and now she's saying that she has nothing. She's called us several times looking for updates, but, you know, we told her several times there's not going to be any updates, he said. In 2023, the FBI reported receiving 69,000 complaints about fraud involving cryptocurrency. In 2024, that number jumped to 149,686. The amount was lost. It was increased from $5.6 billion to $9.3 billion during that same period. Bernstein said his advice is for people to steer clear of words like cryptocurrency or Bitcoin are uttered. It shouldn't be a secret to anybody in this day and age that if you're not already involved in Bitcoin as an investor, then there's really no need to be involved with it, Bernstein said. Wells Fargo is not utilizing Bitcoin to manage your checking account or to fix issues. Watson's hope that a new law that went into effect on the 26th of September will prove that a significant deterrent for the bad guys. The Cryptocurrency Kiosk Alliance Fraud Prevention Law means more warnings will be placed on the machines and they'll start requiring transaction receipts. The law also limits daily transactions to $2,000 per day for new customers and $10,500 for existing customers. Plus, any new customer who reports to an ATM operator that they've been the victim of fraud within 30 days will be entitled to a full refund. Jose Alvarez, manager of Vape Etc. in Green Valley, said he thinks those who use the crypto kiosk in his shop don't even read the warning that's placed on the machine by the Pima County Sheriff's Department several months ago. He said he was unaware of the new law, but said he'd be speaking with the shop's owner to see about removing that machine. It's 9:45. When Yvette Stevenson left Sorrento for Stanford University's Heart Transplant Center on September 12th, she thought she would be there several weeks or even months waiting for a new heart and liver. Instead, she received her new organs just 10 days later and from a surprising and heartbreaking source, Lindsay Stevens, a 31-year-old single mom who also grew up in Sorita. Lindsay's mother, Sharon, said her daughter died on September 18th after suffering an asthma attack while being 4 days earlier. While being transported from the restaurant by ambulance to Northwest Medical Center, Sorita, Lindsay went into cardiac arrest. She was then airlifted to Northwest Medical Center in Tucson, where she was placed on life support to preserve her organs. Upon learning that her daughter would not recover, Sharon recalled a conversation she and Lindsay had had after reading an article in the Green Valley News in early September, detailing Yvette's desperate need for a heart and liver. "It's kind of hard to fathom," said Sharon, who lives in Elephant Head. "Lindsay had read me the article just about 2 weeks before she died." Sharon said that Lindsay was especially saddened by Yvette's situation because they were both single moms. Lindsay's daughter, Marley Rose, is 10 years old. Yvette's daughter, Kaylee, is 15. As it turns out, Sharon knows Yvette's sister, Vanessa, so she reached out to her because Lindsay had decided long ago that given the opportunity, she'd donate her organs. What happened next was a miracle, according to Sharon and Yvette's mom, Sylvia. Lindsay's organs were deemed a good match for Yvette, who was born with tricuspid valvartesia, a congenital heart defect that prevents blood from flowing from the right atrium to the right ventricle. Doctors had been concerned about finding a match for 38-year-old Yvette, but not only because she needed a small heart from a donor with the same blood type, but because they had to be careful about antibodies. "Everything aligned, and you know what's exactly what Lindsay would have wanted," her mother said through her tears. In August, Yvette and Sylvia took classes to prepare her for the surgery and recovery process. They were told complications could arise. "Unfortunately, several have, Sylvia said. After being placed on the heart-lung bypass machine during the procedure, Yvette suffered a stroke that had paralyzed her left side and slightly affected her speech. The doctors also unexpectedly had to add a valve during the surgery. In addition, her kidneys were not functioning consistently. Her pancreas is enlarged, and she's developed pneumonia in both lungs, which is putting a strain on her new heart," Sylvia said. "She also has an infection that doctors are trying to track down. Doctors have had to adjust her medications over the last few days. She's not able to speak at the moment, Sylvia said. "The last 2 days she went backwards, and they said it was because of the high fever. She was delusional more at night, and her anxiety was kicking in. But there are certain things that they can't give her because of the heart," Sylvia said on Thursday. "It's unclear if there will be any lasting effects from the stroke, and they're unable to do a lot of physical therapy because of all the equipment that's attached to her," Sylvia said. "It feels so bad because she thought she was going to get a good heart and a good liver and be able to do a lot of stuff. Never did she think she was going to be paralyzed," Sylvia said. "On the positive side, the liver is doing great," she said. At first, Sylvia said she, her husband Ramon, and Kaylee took turns staying with Yvette, spending a lot of time in the waiting room. But they're no longer allowed to stay in the waiting room, so now they're sleeping at the least expensive motels they can find and living off of credit cards. "It's just been a long road," an exhausted Sylvia said. "They're hoping to get her into a room if she keeps doing better, but she does 2 steps forward and then 1 step backwards." Sylvia said she is so glad that Sharon was willing to talk about Lindsay's generous act. "I wanted to know people to know I know because Stanford, they wanted us to know who it was, but we knew before they did," Sylvia said. "There's another reason that doctors don't like to share who the donors are," she said. "Sometimes they get more depressed because she was already thinking, 'God, somebody has to die to make me live.' That was her thing. She felt bad already, right? But before going in, her sister told her what had happened, and she happened to know her," Sylvia said. "The outpouring of support has helped the family," Sylvia said. "I want to thank everybody down there, anybody that helped us get here and to where we're at. Everybody's support from the community," she said. The employees at Coyote Grill, plan a memorial for Lindsay at 1 o'clock p.m. on October 12th at the restaurant, which is located at 4201 South Camino del Sol. About 2 months before her death, Lindsay moved from Tucson to Green Valley to be closer to her family and work. Working at the Green Valley restaurant was a Stevens family affair. Lindsay worked at Coyote Grill for 5 years. Sharon worked there for 8 years and is the restaurant's assistant manager. Lindsay's younger sister, Toni, has worked there for about 3 years. Sharon remembers Lindsay as beautiful and everybody's friend. She just cared about everybody, she said. She loved people, seriously loved people. She just loved being at work, and she loved her daughter. Grill customers remember Lindsay's care and hard work. She was a remarkable person, and we all grew to love her, said Baron Zovatosky, who frequents the grill with his wife, Paulette. She was the best server any of us had ever had, and that's saying a lot. A big part of our reason for returning there was her superb service, including her provision of time for some good conversation. The Zovatoskys plan to attend the memorial at the grill. How many restaurants do you know that would put on a remembrance event for an employee? Zovatosky said. The memorial will include snacks that Lindsay favored, and cash proceeds from drinks and food will go to the family. Lindsay is also survived by her older sister, Lee Ann Hagen, and Lindsay's finest fiancé, Jacob Jensen. It's 10 minutes in front of 10 o'clock here at Sunsounds. A federal judge is refusing to force the town of Soary to provide a local pastor the name and contact information for the person who called 911 on him 2 years ago, at least for now. Stephen Aiken, the pastor at Southern Arizona Community Church in Green Valley, and his wife Deborah filed a federal lawsuit against the town of Sorita and several police officers after the officers responded to a domestic violence call and used a battering ram to gain entry into the couple's home. Aiken, who is currently representing himself, filed 2 motions complaining that the town of Sorita had failed to provide him with the identity of the woman who called 911 that night of April 2023 or her contact information. The town's attorney, James Jellison, responded by filing a motion asking U.S. District Court Judge Rainer Collins to dismiss Aiken's motion, saying Aiken violated federal rules. Jellison also argued Aiken had made no prior good faith effort to resolve any disputes before filing the motions. Aiken then filed a motion asking Collins to strike Jellison's motion to strike. He also filed an amended version of that motion. On Friday, Collins rendered the first and second motions about the 911 caller moot along with Aiken's first motion to strike. On April 19th of 2023, dispatchers received a 911 call from a woman who said she had heard neighbors arguing for at least 20 minutes and the situation was escalating. When an officer spoke with the caller, she said she heard a man saying, "You will show me respect," something crashing, and a woman yelling, "No, no, no," and "Calm down." According to the officer's depositions and Jellison's motion, Stephen Aiken refused to allow the officers to speak with his wife for 30 minutes, insisting that everybody inside the house was fine. Jellison said that when Deborah Aiken, 71 years old, came to the door, she was wearing a full-sleeve housecoat that covered most of her body, which prevented officers from determining whether or not she had any injuries. In addition, when Mr. Aiken did summons Mrs. Aiken, he continued to do most of the talking and remained with Mrs. Aiken or in close proximity to Mrs. Aiken when she spoke, Jellison said. Now retired Lieutenant Juan Zamora said in his deposition that the officers were particularly concerned that, as formal law enforcement officer, Aiken might have weapons inside the house. The totality of the reporting party's description of the domestic violence incident also concerned me that Mrs. Aiken and other persons inside the residence might require emergency aid and that it was now necessary to discuss her welfare and safety face to face with her, and in a setting where she felt free to share with us what had happened or was happening inside and outside of the presence of Mr. Aiken, Zamorica said in the deposition. Once inside the house, the officers found broken glass in the living room, in the master bedroom and bathroom, displaced furniture and rug and blood on the main bedroom door, a remote control on the floor with the battery cover off, and several firearms and knives throughout the residence. No arrests were made or charges sought because Deborah Aiken denied domestic violence had occurred. According to police reports, Aiken's daughters, Sarah Risco and Stephanie Miramontes Garcia, told the detective that Risco had her roommate call 911 because she'd received a phone call from Deborah Aiken and could hear Stephen yelling and Deborah crying and pleading in the background. Both sisters told police they suspect Stephen Aiken treats her mother poorly and that domestic violence has been an issue in the past that they have witnessed. And taking a look at Meandering the Mesquite, about 5 minutes till, Billy Graham became a national institution. His religious guidance transcended all others, a beacon of Christianity in America. However, he was not the most celebrated of evangelists America had produced. Nope, that distinction belongs to a Canadian-born damsel that entirely captured the nation more than 100 years ago. Graham was born in 1918. That very year, Amy Semple McPherson and her dominant mother landed in Los Angeles and kicked off the most ballyhooed evangelical career America had ever witnessed. Minnie Kennedy dedicated her daughter's life to God at birth. Kennedy was a Salvation Army devotee. Amy's path was predetermined. Her mother would drift in and out of her life with various degrees of influence, but God's work was the constant theme. Amy married an itinerant Irish preacher named Robert Semple. The union was short. He died while they were taking the gospel to China. Returning to the United States, Amy would remarry in 1912 and try her hand at domestic bliss, even bearing a son. It didn't work. The divorce eventually happened in 1921. Mom Minnie had re-entered her life, leading to a trail of evangelical tours, and during the early part of the 20th century, the predominant evangelist was Billy Sunday. Sunday reportedly had preached to more than 100 million followers during his career, giving 60,000 sermons. This part-time professional baseball player had a flamboyant, emotional delivery style that was well-centered by the fear of God and damnation. Amy, calculated or not, sculptured a different message of salvation, and it worked. And I will share the rest of this story with you on Wednesday. That's it for the reading of the Green Valley News. Green, Mark DeGroft with you, wishing you a very pleasant day. Enjoy your programming here on Sun Sounds, and I'll be back on Wednesday. Till then, take care.